Be seated, please.
The court is ready now to hear argument in 070697 Smith versus O'Donnell.
May it please the court. Mr. Dobson will present argument on behalf of the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The question before us is straightforward enough. What is the impact of your decision in Belt on our case? Or to put it in terms of the decision we're here appealing from, was the San Antonio Court of Appeals correct when it said on page 143 of the opinion below that this court in Belt foreclosed a Barcello analysis for suits brought by personal representatives on behalf of an estate? We obviously do not believe that a Barcello analysis is foreclosed by Belt, and we further believe that a Barcello analysis compels this court to uphold our summary judgment on the threshold legal question of duty. To decide whether a Barcello analysis is appropriate in this case, we need to talk about what a Barcello analysis is. I can start by talking about what it is not, and it is not a question for the fact finder. I recall being a little bit taken aback the first time I read the Court of Appeals opinion when they said the following on page 144. Applying Belt to the summary judgment record before us, we agree with O'Donnell that a fact issue exists as to privity, thereby precluding summary judgment in favor of Cox and Smith. A fact issue as to privity. What question is it exactly? Am I going to ask the jury in San Antonio about the purely legal question of privity, or that is to say a duty, whether that exists in this instance? I think that statement by the Court of Appeals that there is a fact issue on this purely legal question reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of what a Barcello analysis is.
But isn't the executor in privity with Cox and Smith?
Your Honor, for purposes of non-estate planning legal malpractice claims, our answer is no. And that is the rule we are urging.
Say Denny had a medical malpractice claim, and attorney told him, you got 4 years to file that, and he dies a year and a half later, or 2.5 years later, and couldn't the estate sue the attorney who gave wrong advice about how long the limitations period was, causing it to lapse? Surely that if that claim survives, put aside survival question, but if the claim survives, the state can bring it, and you're in privity, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we believe the answer to that question is no. We believe that the rule ought to be that for non-estate planning legal malpractice cases unasserted during the decedent's lifetime, the rule ought to that you ought to follow the Barcello analysis, the policy analysis, and the claim you just described should be barred. And why is that? And that's because of the policy. The two overriding policy concerns articulated in Barcello, reaffirmed by Chief Justice Jefferson's opinion in Belt. Number one is a pre-death concern, that by allowing such suits by people other than the client, we're going to interfere with the attorney-client relationship because the attorney feels like he could be second-guessed by someone other than the client. So policy concern number one out of Barcello is before the client dies. Policy concern number two is a very practical concern, a post-death concern, what Barcello called the intolerable tension and proof problems regarding what the decedent's wishes and instructions were as expressed to her lawyer during her lifetime, as opposed to what the now non-clients are saying should and would have been the decedent's instructions and wishes according to them, had they just been properly advised. And Justice Brister, speaking to your hypothetical, I have had in 22 years numerous people pay my firm tens of thousands of dollars, and they'll come in and tell me their tale of woe about breach of fiduciary duty or breach of contract or however they think they've been wronged. And we do a big analysis, and we have them in the office, and I write down the pros and cons of litigation, and numerous people have left my office the last 20-plus years, having been told they have viable causes of action against solvent defendants, and they decide, for numerous reasons, including the cost estimate I gave them, nevertheless, not to pursue it. Now, Let's say that one of those clients leaves my office. A few months later, they die. And their personal representative, who was probably somebody close to them and probably knows about the complaints they came to see me about, but my putative client never related what his final decision was about pursuing that claim. All the personal representative finds is my letter saying, you have viable claims against solvent defendants, but now the statute's run. Well, she sues me, saying...
Right.
And so that is why...
I understand that. Of course, a doctor can make the same argument.
Pardon me?
Doctor can make the same argument. There's no question your malpractice claim against your doctor survives. Doctors say, look, I told them to do this, that, and the other, and this proof problem about who told who to do what, and they said, I don't care, I'm not eating bran muffins the rest of my life, or whatever else.
And
somebody else gets to bring the suit, and the doctors are just out of luck. Why should lawyers be different from doctors?
Because I have tried cases for doctors where one of my main defenses was the plaintiff acted AMI against medical advice. And the difference there is that plaintiff is there for me to cross-examine about them acting AMI.
Not if they died in the interim.
If they died in the interim, that hasn't happened to me. I suppose there could be an instance where that person filed their claim and died, and the estate continues to pursue it, and I haven't had a chance to depose them yet. But I'm not here saying that legal malpractice claims that are brought, that are filed, and then the plaintiff dies, don't get to go forward. I acknowledge that those obviously survive and get to go forward. I'm talking about unasserted, non-estate malpractice claims that were not brought before the decedent passed away.
I didn't see much about this in the briefs. Wouldn't it have been terribly against Mr. Denny's interest, personal interest, to have characterized this differently?
Of course it was, Your Honor. And that
would there have been greater estate tax on his deceased wife's estate?
And Your Honor, among the summary judgment grounds that the Court of Appeals turned us around on that we did not bring to this court was quasi-estoppel. We also had a disgorgement theory that Mr. Denny didn't do anything, if the plaintiffs are correct, that Mr. Denny didn't do anything or his estate didn't do anything but returned that which was never rightfully his. But Mr. O'Donnell, and this is in our briefing and in the summary judgment proof, Mr. O'Donnell, the executor, freely admitted when I deposed him lo these many years ago that Mr. Denny was substantially benefited by the decision that was made regarding the automation industry stock during his lifetime, and it would have been a substantial detriment to him had the decision been another way.
Because it gave him more control over more money and reduced the estate taxes that his wife's estate had.
Exactly, Justice Hecht. It is no mystery as to why Corwin Denny, either as to what his wishes were or why they were that way. Like the most memorable testimony, which is quoted in our brief, is from his fifth wife, Nancy, who said Corwin didn't care when he got it, how he got it, or who he was married to when he got it. It was his. And that was his consistent lifetime position across death, divorce,
and
annulment.
And there's no dispute about this.
I don't believe there's any dispute about that. The only dispute is, according to the plaintiff's summary judgment proof and their expert, if Paul Smith and Jack Ginther had just tried harder, that perhaps they could have gotten Mr. Denny to change his mind. And the failure to try harder is negligence and not writing what we would now colloquially call a CYA letter once he made that decision was negligence. But I don't think there's any dispute about what Corwin wanted. In Belt, you acknowledged Barcelo, and you said that the reason Belt was different from Barcelo is that Belt was an estate planning legal malpractice case. So the two policy concerns that caused you to decide Barcelo as you did were not present in Belt.
We did use that language, but we also wrote more broadly and seemed to pin it to survivability alone. You said if the Turk's legal malpractice claim is brought on behalf of the decedent's estate and survives the decedent, the Turks may maintain a suit against the attorneys. Now, there are other sentences where we throw in estate planning, but there are also pieces of it where we analyze it in terms of survivability.
Justice O'Neill, I realize that, and if that was the end of the question, y'all have had opportunities the last couple years to pour me out before I got all dressed up and came down here this morning. The survivability issue was necessary to your analysis in Belt, but it was not sufficient. You went on and considered the Barcello factors. You said, because this is an estate planning legal malpractice case, we don't have to worry about that divided loyalty, about that interference with the attorney-client relationship while the client's alive, because we know that the object of the representation and the instruction was, limit my estate tax liability. Second, you said in Belt that because this was an estate planning legal malpractice claim, as opposed to another kind of claim, that you weren't going to have to engage in what Chief Justice Jefferson called in Belt the near impossible task of proving what a decedent's intent would have been in other non-estate planning circumstances, because we know that the intent of the representation in Belt was to decrease estate taxes. No, the lawyer defendants, nobody was going to claim in the Belt case that Mr. Turk, the decedent in that case, walked into the Oppenheimer Blend firm in San Antonio and said, boys, the object of my representation is to pay the maximum estate tax liability. That intolerable conflict, what Chief Justice Jefferson called the near impossible task, you said was not going to be present in Belt because that was the kind of case we're talking about.
How would you address the argument that the points you just made from Belt are that legal advice, the propriety of which you don't know till after death, is what Belt was talking about, not something narrowly just about estate planning?
And Justice Wainwright, I would address that in this way. You said in Belt that one of the reasons you decided Belt the way you did is that if you didn't, it might give a free pass to lawyers that engaged in faulty estate tax planning advice because the consequences of that bad advice would rarely be known until after death. Contrast that with our case. Contrast that with the position we've taken here. Well, what we're saying is that in non-estate planning malpractice, that those claims, such as the claim in this case, readily could have been discovered and litigated in the decedent's lifetime. And that's what we're saying should be barred under the Barcello analysis. Look at the two Barcello policy factors in light of the facts of this case. Do we have the potential, if Paul Smith and Jack Ginther can be hauled into court 40 years later to answer for their advice, do we have the potential, looking back, if you knew these kind of claims could come, that you'd have divided loyalty as to Corwin when Corwin was taking the adamant position, this is what I want? What if that lawyer's sitting there thinking, well, gosh, when old Corwin dies, I might get sued by the people that could ultimately be the beneficiaries of another decision? So you've got that Barcello factor. And then as to the second Barcello factor, what the Belt opinion calls the near impossible task of ferreting out the wishes and intent and instructions of the decedent as expressed to his lawyers as opposed to what the non-client is saying now, we've got that here in spades. I mean, you can see the tension that your opinion talked about in Barcello in the briefs in this case, and I suspect in the arguments in this court this morning. Mr. Smith and Mr. Ginther have testified, look, we showed him the 20-page Smyer memo. We probably told him his California oral agreement with his wife was no good. We talked to his accountant. We talked to his California lawyer. And Corwin nevertheless made this decision. The plaintiff comes back and says, well, that's not good enough. You should have been more forceful. You should have written a CYA letter. Perhaps you should have withdrawn from the representation before you did this. And now, if I've got to try this case, I've got to go back without obviously the benefit of Corwin's testimony and try to prove what Corwin wanted. I believe this is why Chief Justice Jefferson called this a near impossible task. Just as one example, Texas Rule of Evidence 601B, the dead man statute. I wouldn't be surprised if in the unfortunate circumstance you send me back down to try this case, Jack Ginther and Paul Smith had individual meetings with Corwin that they've testified about, where they said, Corwin said, no way, heck no, no declaratory judgment, that stuff's mine. Well, I wouldn't be surprised when we go back down if they don't say, under Rule 601B, I can't get that in. Just as the Dallas Court of Appeals very recently said in the Coleman versus Coleman case, One business partner dies. Executrix, his wife, says, I want you to wind up this partnership and distribute my husband's share of the assets. The living partner says, oh, no, we had an oral deal about how this was going to be handled. And the Dallas Court of Appeals said, sorry, you don't get to testify about that under Rule 601B. And so we've got the near impossible task, what you called in Belt the immediate tension, that policy implication of Barcelo is implicated here. So unless y'all got questions, I'll sit down and wait for rebuttal.
Are there any questions? There are none. Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
It pleases the court. Mr. Marable will present argument on behalf of the respondents.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. Justice Brisker, I think you asked the first question was, isn't the executor in privity? And I would direct you to, it's head note 17 in Belt, where Chief Justice, writing in the 8-0 opinion, says, it's undisputed that the Turks are the independent executors of the estate. I'm paraphrasing. They may bring the claim on behalf of the estate. We previously, as the personal representative, we previously held a bankruptcy trustee can maintain a legal malpractice claim, and we say this holding is in accord with other jurisdictions, which is recognized that because the estate stands in the shoes, it's in privity. So in answer to that first question, Belts decided that issue, that there is privity in that regard.
Suppose the children had brought this lawsuit rather than the executor. What would the result be?
In the sense of the proof or in the sense of the ultimate result of the case at the end of the day?
The sense, how would it be different? The proof, I assume, is the same, but...
I don't think it would be different other than the...
Would they be out under Barcelo?
No.
They wouldn't be in privity.
I'm sorry, who
would... They would not be in privity.
Corwin Denny had sued Cox and Smith, there'd be privity.
If the children had sued Cox and
Smith. If the children had filed a lawsuit against Cox and
Smith. This suit, if the children had filed this suit against Cox and Smith.
There is no privity. They could not have filed this lawsuit against Cox and Smith.
So why do they sue an executor who's probably sympathetic, and then the executor sues the lawyer?
They sue the executor because he is legally responsible for Corwin Denny not funding the trust correctly from 68 through the date that he dies. He's the only the claim that they file is because you didn't put the money into the trust like you should have, and we're now entitled to all of this money, the money that should have been in there, plus the penalties, plus the interest.
What do you suppose would have been the result if they'd sued their father while he was still alive?
For not putting it in correctly? Then you would have litigated this issue of whether or not I had put that in correctly and whether or not I had engaged in any misconduct. And Corwin Denny would have said, I believe that, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, go ahead, Justice.
There would have been some hard feelings over that.
Would have been hard feelings. Number two, Corwin Denny would have said what he said. He said, I don't think that it's community property. I think it was separate property, and I funded it correctly. And I think that gets into your question and this argument that we are trying to do something which is contrary to the intent of Corwin Denny. And I think this goes to an issue which Justice Brister even raised in oral arguments in the Belt case. There's one thing to get into a fight where daddy goes to the estate planning lawyer and says, I'm going to allocate this money to this child and this money to this child. And after his death, they come in and say, no, daddy wanted me to have more. He didn't want that child to have any. That is an issue that is raised, and Justice Brister raised that, and that's what I think there was a reference to Justice Jefferson referencing the near impossibility of trying to decide these issues. I think that's Justice Phillips' comment from Barcelo, not the Chief Justice's comment. It is a different issue when you have Corwin Denny who says, it is my personal belief that this is separate property, not community. And the lawyers don't tell him, Corwin, you are wrong. It's not. And on this record, that is the evidence, and that is the finding in this case. I agree. He believed it, and in fact, there's a quote from the woman he was married, his last wife, who said he believed that it was his, regardless of when he acquired it or how he acquired it. If somebody walked in to any family law practitioner and said, "That's my belief," the family law practitioner would have to tell him and say, "I don't know any jurisdiction which recognizes that. I believe it's a strongly held belief, but you're wrong." That's what the...
So you're saying the difference in this and Belt or Barcelo is that here he had a duty. He wasn't just making a discretionary decision.
That's part of it. But the other part of it is that you resolved, when I say you, this court and Justice Green was not sitting. It's the same panel members. You resolved this type of issue in the Belt case when you said, this type of problem can come up when the beneficiary of the will is also the executor. Because in Belt, you asked the counsel petitioner several times. You said, look, the executor of the estate a lot of times is a beneficiary, and you got this problem where you've got the same person asserting a claim in his capacity as an executor, but is also a beneficiary. And there's two footnotes in the opinion.
What's the fact question that is that you would ask the jury in this case?
Well, if you
about
submit
his intent or what he would have done.
Well, you wouldn't submit an intent question. You'd submit a broad form negligence question. The negligence, if any, of Cox and Smith proximately caused damage.
And what's the evidence of the negligence?
The negligence is not telling him you cannot characterize the property this way.
And what's the evidence of what his reaction would have been?
He would have followed his lawyer's advice.
That's the evidence?
That is the evidence. And there's evidence in the... Here is the global evidence, and here's the arguments made in the Court of Appeals. Justice Jefferson, let me get right back to you. Footnote 7 and footnote 8 of the Belt opinion discuss the two situations where the executor is also a beneficiary, is required to come in and show the actual intent of the client. And what this court said is it's issues of proof. If you can't prove what the intent was, then you lose your case, and that's how y'all dealt with it in terms of an evidentiary issue. The actual evidence, and this was a part of the summary judgment arguments made, Cox and Smith took the position that Corwin had decided to characterize this as community, as separate, so therefore there could be no negligence, not negligence, because they didn't argue that. Quasi-estoppel precluded the claim because he had made that decision, and therefore they could not be held responsible for it. Now, what the Fourth Court of Appeals said is you never told him that he could not do it because it was wrong. And the evidence that was relied upon is evidence, and Mr. Wagner took the deposition, and it goes something like this. Did he follow his lawyers? And he's talking to Mr. Smith, who represented him for a number of years. And Mr. Smith said yes, and he kept pursuing it by saying as follows. Is he the kind of guy that's kind of wishy-washy about this, that, you know, he'll follow it, but you're not really too sure? Or if you tell him that that's what it is, does he follow it? And he says, I know of no instance when he was told, you know, what the advice was, that he didn't follow it. And that is in the Fourth Court of Appeals opinion, and that's the evidence. And that's what's going to go to the jury.
I just want to make sure, the same question I asked the petitioner, that this would have cost him money.
Yes.
And it would have been more taxes to his wife's estate, and he would have had less control over less money.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it would have been a situation where it wouldn't have cost him money in the sense that the money that his wife's estate would have been money that his wife's estate's paid. But clearly, he would have had a smaller amount of money for his estate. There's no question about that. And the question that the jury would have to decide is that if he was told, you cannot do it this way, you have got to allocate that $1.8 million, and if he said, I don't care, I'm going to do it that way, and I'm going to take the risk, and I'm going to go ahead and not fund these trusts like I should, then if the jury believes that that's what he's going to do, then you lose the case because you can't show that Cox and Smith's negligence was a proximate cause. But in terms of...
Would the jury have to, or would there be evidence on what he would have done if his, if he'd been sued sooner, if his children had sued him sooner? Is that the kind of thing the trial should get into? Whether he would have cut them off and taken all the income out of the wife's trust and made sure they didn't get a penny? Do you think that's irrelevant in the case?
I'll be honest with you. I don't know in the context of how you would do it, but I would believe that it probably comes in under a theory that, I mean, they've got a theory in this case that this was a setup between O'Donnell and the beneficiaries of the trust, not of the, of Mr. Denny's wife's trust, not the beneficiaries of his will. That's his last wife.
The beneficiaries of the wife's trust are all the kids, right?
True. And so the issue is, does this theory that they've got come in that they waited right until at the end because they didn't want to make their dad mad and they were trying to increase what they could have received because he didn't give them anything? I think it probably does, because I think it probably may have some bearing on their argument that it was his intent the whole time to do it this way. I mean, I can't think of a way that I would exclude it right now. And my response to that is what we've tried to say in the brief. Mr. O'Donnell was not a beneficiary of any of this. He was an executor who hired Gibson Dunn. Gibson Dunn looked at it and said, this thing's going to risk the whole estate. Y'all need to settle it. That our response would be is that we did what our lawyers told us to do, and our lawyers looked at it and said it's because Cox and Smith made a mistake on this back in 1968.
And the fee that's recited in the brief was all for this part of the work, or did Gibson Dunn do some other representation for the executive?
As I understand it, the amount, which I believe is 2.3, right, is attributable solely to defending the fiduciary litigation filed by the beneficiaries of Mr. Denny's wife's trust. There was a question of that in the deposition of Mr. Ruskey, and he said and acknowledged that attorney's fees that Gibson Dunn would have had to have expended, they would have expended anyway in handling the estate, would not be recoverable by Cox and Smith. And his affidavit attributes that. If there is some distinction, I'm sure, and plus, I believe y'all have the issue right now in front of you whether or not attorney's fees from collateral litigation can constitute damages anyway in legal malpractice cases from the Akin Gump case.
What's your position, briefly, in regard to the dead man statute?
The answer is it's the first time that I've heard the question today, but and I don't the case out of Dallas has not been cited, but I have not seen a recent case in which anybody has successfully used it, because there's usually exceptions, and because there, as I recall, and I'm talking about this hearing at about 2 minutes ago.
Corroboration.
I don't see that there's an issue or fight here about corroboration. We agree as to what his position was. I mean, it's his position that it's mine. The legal issue and the malpractice issue is, and you should have been told that you were wrong. So I don't see that they're going to be deprived of defense under a dead man statute issue. But I think that goes to an issue that Justice Hecht asked the petitioners in Belt. He said, isn't there an unfairness about this? Because he was asking specifically about O'Donnell. He said, look, the malpractice in that case occurred 30 years ago. Isn't there some type of unfairness, or isn't there a difficulty in trying to defend these cases that have happened like this in the past? And the answer that you got in that case, Justice Hecht, was that the difficulties in the defense of the proof and things like that does not justify not recognizing the cause of action. I want to address that issue, because you did hear that from opposing counsel in terms of this unfairness and the difficulty he's got trying to defend this. The person that has a problem in trying to present the case, if there is a problem, is going to be the plaintiff, because my client's passed away. So I'm the one that's going to have to be able to meet my burden of proof, I'm going to have to be able to present some evidence as to what he would have done, which is this issue that we've been talking about. Because, in fact, that is one of the issues, in Justice Brister, when I referred to those two footnotes from the Belt case, that talked about what the burden was of the executor beneficiary in that case to present evidence in order to successfully pursue the claim. So I'm in a situation where, you know, I don't have a live client there who was deposed, and I've got to present that testimony in the case without it. But that issue that they're talking about, that he's got his lawyers and there's no client there to depose, that's going to exist in any case like this once the client's passed away, because he's obviously deceased. It could have happened 2 days and 2 years ago. When that lawsuit gets filed, I don't have a live client that I can put on the stand to ask these kind of questions that he's saying it is affecting his defense. Now, and you've seen the record in this case. This is not a case in which the underlying documents have been destroyed or we've lost every witness, because I believe that in the testimony there's about 300 boxes of underlying documents that were discussed by the lawyers in the depositions involving Mr. Ruskey. And the reason is because Mr. Denny never threw anything away, and he wrote a biography which detailed his life. I mean, this is a case in which no one is going to be in a situation where they cannot put on a legitimate defense if that's a legitimate concern. But the other thing is, we litigate cases like this all the time. I mean, in National Gas Pipeline, y'all were addressing an issue in 2001 where they had leases that they were arguing terminated 59 years before the lawsuit was filed. And San Antonio just issued an opinion finding a termination of a lease based on activity.
Well, you can imagine if Barcelo applies in a case like this, that when the client is giving advice, the lawyer is giving advice to his or her client, that, well, maybe it makes sense to bring in, you know, the children and the beneficiaries and get releases, and, you know, because you worry some, and the law changes, and, you know, there are impacts that might extend far beyond decades later. And are you thinking about more protecting yourself or imagining these lawsuits from beneficiaries, or are you advising your client? Doesn't it drive kind of a stake between the lawyer and client, and perhaps make the lawyer act in his or her self-interest?
No. And the reason is because the beneficiaries that you are talking about would be the beneficiaries of the – I mean, there's two sets of beneficiaries. When you, Chief Justice, you say beneficiaries, there would be beneficiaries of the underlying will of Corwin Denny, which is the foundation, and Nancy Denny. And then you had the beneficiaries of this trust. Everybody that was involved in this case, Mr. Smith, and it's Mr. I believe it's Ginther or Gunther. I don't pronounce the name correctly. He knew when they're doing the separate versus community allocation, he knew that that was an important issue for Corwin, for the deceased wife's estate, and for all the people that were going to take under the trust. He wasn't doing anything different or not different. That's why he suggested that option of the declaratory judgment, because everybody knew that if you didn't do it right and you made a mistake on this, you got an improper funding of the trust. So you don't have any of the – I mean, that argument was made by opposing counsel, but I don't think you've got any situation where he's saying, well, I'm concerned about what advice I can give you because of potential lawsuits.
Well, I'm talking about in the future. If this is the – I mean, if we decide the case in favor of your client, and in under these circumstances there's privity and potential liability, then in the next interaction between a lawyer and a client in a case like this, I mean, aren't you thinking well beyond your client? You're thinking about yourself. You're thinking about any others that might be impacted and might ultimately sue me.
Absolutely not. You're thinking about whether, I mean, if Corwin Denny comes in and he says, I think the number was $33 or $39 million. He says, my wife's died. I got $39 million between the two of us. And she's got trusts that have been set up, and I got to fund these trusts. Okay? I mean, we all know what you got to do. You got to fund the trust properly. So, I mean, you're not thinking and worrying about, you know, well, I'm going to do something different because I can get sued. You're sitting there knowing if you don't do it right, there is going to be a potential claim because your client is committed a breach of fiduciary duty.
It's always shades and faces. I mean, he might also say, and I don't want to put a dime more in them than I have to.
That I agree with you, and I think that that's the underlying
so
case.
So if there's a 50% chance it's going to be improper, I want to take that risk. If there's a 70%, if there's a 90%, I don't want to take that risk.
And that is the issue that I think maybe gets to the crux of this, because the Cox & Smith lawyers didn't say it's 20% or 90% or there's some potential issue. They did two things.
Lawyers never do.
The issue, I think, in this case, and that's what terrified the Gibson Dunn lawyer that looked at this, he was like, there is no way that you could allow him to sign off on this. You had to tell him no or properly fund it.
But doesn't that go to the claim? I mean, that goes to the liability claim and not whether it can be brought. I mean, you may ultimately lose it.
Right.
And it may be barred by limitations.
All these issues, frankly, the issues we've been talking about, most of them, are all underlying liability merit issues. And even the Justice Hex issue about, you know, well, if it had been 80% or if it's 60%, I might want to make that decision and do it. That's a merits issue, too. Because if he was given that advice and decided, I'm going to roll the dice and risk it, then they can successfully try to argue that there is no negligence, they didn't violate any duty. But that's the underlying merits of the case, as to which the Fourth Court's already said, we're going back. It has nothing to do with whether or not there's a Barcelo issue or privity in that. And I'm out of time, so I'll stand for any other questions.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court. Justices, the kind of questions you are asking about the underlying lawsuit where the Denny children sued their father's estate and the Gibson Dunn and Crutcher representation and kind of how we got here are the reason we are urging this court to adopt a bright line rule. These children waited 30 years after their mother died to file this case, but only 34 days after their father died, and it's exactly for the reason Justice Heck suggested.
Why wouldn't you decide that on limitations or latches?
Your Honor, limitations in this case, it'd be a discovery rule case, so it'd be my burden to go on and put proof that Corwin Denny knew of sufficient facts to put a reasonable person on inquiry notice that he had a claim against his lawyers, and thus the clock began running and ran out. How am I going to prove that in 2009? I can't cross-examine Corwin. The people I'd really like to depose are his longtime California accountant, Joe Schneider.
Well, you say that they told him there was a problem. They put him on notice that there was a problem.
Yes, ma'am.
And he should have known then that there was a problem there.
And if you make me try this case, believe me, I will be trotting that theory out. But I fear that in a situation where I've got the burden of proof, the jury's going to also want to hear from people like Joe Schneider or Corwin's longtime California lawyer, who the undisputed summary judgment proof is, after he got the advice from Paul Smith and Jack Ginther, he went back to California and discussed this with Mr. Schneider and his California lawyer, whose names escape me. Mr. Schneider's passed away. The California lawyer has Alzheimer's. The telling me that I can go litigate the discovery rule, Your Honor, I submit, is not a reasonable substitute for the bright line that I'm asking the court to draw here. Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher charged $2.3 million to this estate, and for $2.3 million managed to take a grand total of one deposition, that of Paul Smith, who 30 years later, without reviewing any documents and only having fond memories of his old friend and client Corwin, is asked the question, to the best of your recollection, Mr. Smith, was Mr. Denny always somebody who followed his lawyer's advice? And Paul said, yeah, best as I recall, he was that kind of guy. Well, that is the slender reed that we're going to go try this case on if we don't draw this bright line. It was a setup to come and take his deposition, and Keith Kaiser, The former general counsel of Cox and Smith, my longtime friend, defended that deposition, and as firm counsel is the one who Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher set it up through. And he says it was a setup, but I can't depose him because, unfortunately, we lost Keith to cancer a couple years ago. And you see this story over and over and over again in this case.
You think the bright line should be where?
The bright line should be this. For non-estate planning, legal malpractice cases, unasserted at time of death, that could have been discovered and litigated during the decedent's lifetime, the Barcello rule ought to cut that off. Mr. O'Donnell made the decision to pay the Denny children in the underlying case $13 million without filing a motion for summary judgment as to limitations and after taking one deposition, a decision that probably didn't just have old Corwin rolling over in his grave but spinning in it. But under Barcello, the estate should now not be able to visit the consequences of that decision on my clients and force them to litigate the question of what did Corwin Denny really want done and what were his instructions really were 40 years ago. As a matter of policy, don't make Corwin Denny's attorneys try to perform what, and Chief Justice Jefferson, it is, in your opinion, in Belt, the near impossible task of litigating his long ago intents and instructions.
Would it make any difference if there had been affirmative advice saying, don't put this stock into your wife's trust. It is separate property, and that were just clearly wrong. I mean, it seems like we're talking a lot about the facts, and if we come out with the rule you propose, it could wipe out a lot of very good claims as well, based on the facts before us.
Your Honor, I believe that the bright line rule that I am urging the court to adopt will eliminate more claims that shouldn't be brought than more legitimate claims than should. I think it will be the rare case indeed when a non-estate planning legal malpractice claim that could have been discovered and litigated.
I would probably disagree with that assessment, but are there any other jurisdictions that have adopted that rule?
No, ma'am, and in fact, we are one of only 8 states who even follow the Barcello rule. We're in a distinct minority here, so looking to other states.
And none that would follow the rule you propose? None that follow that rule?
None of the 8 that are like us, I am not sure if any. I am sure that those 8 have not spoken to this precise question. I don't believe with the exception. Well, I honestly don't remember the exception. And in some cases will be lost, Justice O'Neill, but just like your opinion says in Barcello, yes, some legitimate cases will be lost if we draw this bright line, but the greater good is served by drawing the line, and that's what we urge the court to do. Thank you all very much.
Further questions? Thank you. The cause is submitted, and that concludes arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.